Well, good evening, everyone. Oh, boy. Oh, got it. Okay. I almost dropped the ball, but I found it. Okay. Let's open up to 2 Kings. Headed to Isaiah here momentarily. Let's see. 2 Kings chapter 15. Okay, a couple things. So a few weeks ago, I mentioned trying to find a platform, a web-based platform where I could send out text messages really easy, and I found that. And I put all 110 of your numbers in there. And then Ann City says, I want to get immersed. And I said, what a good opportunity to use my new system. So beep, send. 60% of them failed. And one of the brethren were like, I think you put my number in wrong because I haven't gotten any of them text messages you've been talking about. And so the program's struggling. I guess there's a lot of regulation that's come in recently that's restricting. It's amazing. That's what regulation does. The company's been really great about trying to help, but it's becoming very apparent that they are not going to be able to get ahead of this. So just politely ask for my money back and then try a different platform. So that's why maybe you've only got one message from me this whole time, is it's not working. And but I'm not giving up, because we did send some Facebook messages out about a couple of immersions that have happened recently, and some of you came up to me and said, I didn't know. It's not all of us see this somewhere on Facebook, and some of us who have Facebook, you know, don't check it every hour. So I do think that this is a good idea. The one that I found is not going to work. So, and then about a month ago, I did say, if you have Bible questions, feel free to text them in or to call or just to grab me and let me know. I had one come in last week, and then I forgot to answer it. So I'm learning as well. 2 Kings chapter 15, let's read verses 1 through 4, and then I will be looking for a King James here. In the 27th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Azariah, son of Amaziah, king of Judah, became king. Now, there's Ahaziah's and Amaziah's and Ahaziah's, and then, you know, but then there's like an Amaziah on the south and Amaziah in the north, and some of them are prophets. If you're ever lost, you're not alone. Verse 2, he was 16 years old when he became king. He reigned 52 years in Jerusalem, and his mother's name was Jechaliah of Jerusalem. He did right in the sight of the Lord according to all that his father Amaziah had done. Only the high places were not taken away, and the people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. Okay, so if you've read your Old Testament recently, many, many of the introductions to the king starts this way. Specifically, that they did right in the sight of the Lord, which you can also notice if you compare Chronicles, it'll typically say, in the days of Zechariah the priest, which means when the priest was alive, they kept their act together. But then when the priest would die, the king wouldn't have anybody spiritual to consult, so he'd just start consulting himself, and then the whole thing would fall apart. But the way that this also is very consistent is it says only the high places were not taken away. That is also a very common thread that runs through. I just finished reading through the Kings, or pretty close, at least to the part where all the Israel kings have run their course. What a mess. I mean, what a mess. You go chapter by chapter by chapter, and not a good thing is being done. Okay? And then you get to the end, and there's just a king every other year, because they can't get it together. Okay? And then you can see why the nation eventually collapses. Here's the question. Bible question. How can King Azariah do what is right in the eyes of the Lord, yet the high places are not taken away? Doesn't seem to be right. Did anybody find the King James for me? 3 and 4.
You want to just read it?
Yeah. Okay. And he did that which was right in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah had done, save that the high places were not removed. So ours says only, but for my head, and then I'll let you guys comment here if you want, But for my mind, that makes a lot more sense. He did what was right in the sight of the Lord, except. That's what save means. He did everything that was right except this thing. Okay, so a very, very good question, but I do believe it has a very simple answer. What it's saying, it's not saying he did what was right in the sight of the Lord by leaving the high places up. Is it generally did fairly well, and most of them started fairly well, okay? It's how they ended, all right? In fact, the account that I read just yesterday was Uzziah. He doesn't get the name Uzziah in the Kings. That name is more prominent in the prophet Isaiah. But this guy starts out great. I mean, like, really good. And then the guy dies a leper. So it's just he enters the temple, burns incense on the altar. He's not supposed to do that. And then he was proud when he was doing it and unrepentant. So God struck him as a leper. So it's another good side lesson to remember. It is much more important to God how you finish than how you start. So any other comments on that question or anything? Maybe you've had that question before. That any insight anybody wants to add on to that? Only.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like only the high places were not taken away.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Only the high places were not taken away. So I just like the way it save this. Just accept this. Brad, did you have something you were going to holler out?
Yeah, you were talking about how God wants to see how someone finishes.
Yes. Absolutely. And language like those who are being saved is used in the New Testament. And work out your salvation. I mean, that's a process with fear and trembling. So, yeah. Great question.
You don't want to address any questions unless they're first texted to you.
Initially, yeah, let's do that. Okay. Just so it's fruitful for both sides. Because okay. I'm just being completely frank with you. I mean, you guys could probably start busting them out, and I might know the answer off the top of my head for maybe half of them. And I don't know if that's fruitful either, just being honest with you guys. So I've been at it a year. In 20 years, maybe you can blow me up on the spot, Kevin. No, I know. Okay, we're in Isaiah. Maybe some of you guys saw my Facebook post this week. I just got too excited. I couldn't wait till Wednesday. I had to just, you know, it's like, you know, this Messianic prophecy study has been good. I've really enjoyed it. I got a lot of good feedback from you guys. But man, when you arrive at Isaiah 53, it's like, don't miss this one. Like, if you haven't been here yet, make sure you show up tonight. So we got about 2 or 3 weeks, more like three weeks to get through it all. Now, maybe you haven't noticed this before, but you can't cover Isaiah 53 without covering Isaiah 52. Now, I'm not going to drag us all the way through 52, although it's not too long. I am going to have us start in verse 13, and then I'll explain kind of what we missed here. 52, verse 13. Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. Just as many were astonished at you, my people, so his appearance was marred more than any other man, and his form more than the sons of men. Thus he will sprinkle many nations. Kings will shut their mouths on account of him. For what they had not been told, they will see, and what they had not heard, they will understand. Who's believed our message? To whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of parched ground, he had no... Let me back up. Verse 2. For he grew up before him like a tender shoot, and like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised, and we did not esteem him. Surely our griefs he himself bore, and our sorrows he carried. Yet we ourselves esteemed him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was pierced through for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The chastening for our well-being fell upon him, and by his scourging we are healed. All of us like sheep have gone astray. Each of us has turned to his own way. But the Lord has caused the iniquity of us all to fall on him. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he did not open his mouth. Like a lamb that's led to slaughter, and like a sheep that's silent before its shears, so he did not open his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. As far as his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living for the transgression of my people, to whom the stroke was due? His grave was assigned with wicked men, yet he was with a rich man in his death, because he had done no violence. Nor was there any deceit in his mouth. But the Lord was pleased to crush him, putting him to grief. If he would render himself as a guilt offering, he will see his offspring, he will prolong his days, and the good pleasure of the Lord will prosper in his hand. As a result of the anguish of his soul, he will see it and be satisfied. And by his knowledge, the righteous one, my servant, will justify the many, and he will bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will allot him a portion with the great, and he will divide the booty with the strong, because he poured out himself to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he himself bore the sins of many and interceded for the transgressors. Isaiah has been called the Mount Everest of prophetic literature. Now, whether you want to go with that terminology or not, doesn't matter to me. But if Isaiah is the great mountain, chapter 53 is the summit of that mountain. Chapter 53 follows a chapter depicting the exaltation of Israel. Now, hopefully what we notice right away in verse 13 is he addresses my servant. Okay. Now, this theme, servant, has been coming through very strong, especially in chapter 49, right before it, and then even in 42 before that. This language, because typically up to a few weeks ago, God has referred to his nation as his servant. But it does change to the servant, and we've seen that the last couple studies, and that he's referring to the Messiah, because then we've been able to match the New Testament verses that tell us this indeed is fulfilled in Jesus. So Isaiah 52, though, is talking about the exaltation of the nation. If you look at verse 1, it says, "Awake, awake, clothe yourself in strength, O Zion." Okay? Zion, referring to Jerusalem, referring to the nation of Israel. All right? So, pick yourself up. You know, verse 2, "Shake yourself from the dust. Rise up, O captive Jerusalem. Loose yourself from the chains around your neck, O captive daughter of Zion." So we have the exaltation of Israel. All right? The exaltation, though, is possible because God's Messiah will be exalted. Okay? The nation will not rise from its dust and be able to shake off its shackles until Jesus comes and is able to free us from the real shackles that God cares about, the shackles of sin. You know, Brad made that point earlier. We were sinners separated from God prior to our conversion. All right? So this exaltation cannot be fully fulfilled apart from Jesus being exalted. So we see in verse 13 the switch to "my servant will prosper." Okay? And then we're heading into chapter 53, so we understand that it's referring to Jesus. But sometimes when I see appropriate, I do like us to understand some alternate interpretations. Okay? And I want us to be able to work through these so we're equipped. Some, mainly Jewish descent, but also some recent from among the God-fearing, have moved away from a messianic interpretation of Isaiah chapter 52 and 53 and related the passage to collective servant of God, Israel. Nobody gasped, so do I need to say that again? So it doesn't surprise us that the Jews hold that perspective. They're doing everything they can to remove any inkling of Jesus in the Old Testament. Okay, I saw a video of a guy who can speak Hebrew from America go over to Jerusalem and interview people on the street, and he quoted verses from Isaiah chapter 53, and he could speak Hebrew, so he was able to relate to the people, and the people are like, "I've never seen that in the Bible before." They took it out. Okay, but there are contemporaries among the God-feeling who all... God-feeling. God-fearing that hold this position. And what they're saying is the language is servant Zion, servant Zion, servant Israel. That language should carry through all the way through chapter 53. So then they take the predictive text of chapter 53 and apply it to the nation of Israel. Now, some of you got a scrunched look on your face. That's the look I was looking for the first time. Okay, but I mean, this is an email that's worth sending to the Lockman Foundation. But did you see verse 14? Now, we need to read verse 13, but peel your eyes back for verse 14. Behold my servant. So here's the question. Is the servant Messiah or is the servant Zion, Jerusalem? Okay, Israel. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. That's the context of the chapter. Israel will be exalted. So they say Israel will be exalted. Verse 14. Just as many were astonished at you, my people. They're saying the you, the person who's just been exalted, is the people. Now, it's italicized, and I do thank the Lockman Foundation for that, because that's their way of saying context, and the language of the tone of the language dictates this translation, but that word, my people, does not show up. So when you see italicized sections in your Bible, that's them saying this comes through in the English okay, but the literal rendering is not there in the Hebrew. And for the most part, they do okay. For the most part. But just please see so that you are equipped, because then I can move on to my next point. Just see, even the translators here are holding to the position that chapter 52, verse 13 through 15 is still referring to Israel. Because they said, the lofty exalted one, you, my people. Okay? So, I guess the King James, did you have that up, Jared? Can I grab you for that? Yeah, I think just verse 14.
As many as were astonished at thee, his visage was so marred, more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men.
Now, doesn't that just make more sense? I'm going to have him read it again. His servant will be exalted, verse 13. Here's verse 14.
As many were astonished at thee, his visage was so marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men.
Okay. So, I went and did a little digging, and the NASB is definitely in the minority on this. I mean, most of them just translate it literally through, you will be exalted, his figure was marred. Our translations are saying, you will be exalted, and you, my people, are marred and disfigured. So, just that was a new one that I stumbled on this week. I did want to bring this up because I do know that it is a held belief among religious circles. So now you won't be taken back if someone brings this up. But I do want us to see. Now, we're going to spend 3 weeks studying this, and the New Testament is just going to completely answer it for us. Okay? But I did come up with some help of some literature, I did come up with just three main reasons I want you to consider this morning why that interpretation is just flat wrong. Okay? Reason number one, it takes extreme prejudice or inventful imagination to attribute such strong individualistic language to the collective. What am I saying? You gotta stretch that really far to get it to say it's referring to the whole group. When the language that's going to follow from here on through the end of the chapter is so strongly pointed towards an individual. You really have to have an imagination or prejudice to stretch it so far that you're going to let that stand for collective Israel and not let it stand for his servant, the coming Messiah. Reason number two, the predictions here, as we kind of remember some of the predictions from chapter 53, the predictions here far exceed what mankind can accomplish on his own. So if someone's going to hold to that position that this is referring to Israel as the collective, How does Israel as the collective fulfill the things that are said in Isaiah 53? Okay, but a man did. All right, that man, Jesus Christ. And then number three, I mentioned this earlier, we have, near as I can count, at least six New Testament passages teaching that this has direct fulfillment through Jesus Christ. So, and that's kind of been the tone for our class here, is just let the New Testament answer it for us, and then we end our questions there, but did want to throw those in. Any thoughts or comments on that initial section there as we kind of do a quick little intro into this chapter? Yeah. Okay.
Another option here on verse 14, Isaiah 52, is he's making a correlation comparison. Just as many were astonished at you, my people, I haven't investigated this, but I just sitting here thinking about it. They may have added that saying that as Israel was debased by the nations at the hand of God, maybe he's trying to make a correlative comparison here that so this individual's appearance was marred, debased, more than any other man. I'm going to look into that.
Yeah, do you look into it? My mind went down that road specifically yesterday, and I didn't follow it all the way out. But the one thing I did notice that kind of made me just be like, yeah, I'm going to stop, is some of the translations come through, and they say something to the effect of, just as many were astonished at you, the multitudes were astonished at you. And so it gave the impression that the people were astonished at Jesus. So the way the NASB is trying to pull through this multitude that they're translating my people, here it's being given a direct address, which I say is incorrect. But they have this here because there's something in the Hebrew that's coming through that the multitude looked upon him. And I think that's more accurate. Because I saw those, I just kind of figured that's probably what's going on there. But, you know, if you continue to look it up that week, come back next week. Yeah, any other comments on that? I hope that made sense. You know, I only try to bring these things up if I think they're going to be fruitful. All right? It doesn't surprise you that not everybody agrees that some of this stuff's messianic. I mean, they're out there trying to disprove Jesus' messiahship. Okay? But just in case that one ever comes your way, this is why they hold that position, and this is where some of it's kind of overlapping. The other thing here, and then we'll jump right into the end of 52. The other thing I just want you guys to notice is just the way that the chapter's written. Just notice it's broken up in sections of three. So I don't have a Bible that breaks these things up. You might, but you'll see verse... Do you guys have verse 1 through 3, and then there's space between that, and then verse 4 through 6? That's done on purpose, and that's done rightfully so. I do like that they do that. Okay, because what you're going to notice is 13 through 15 is three verses, and then 10 through 12 in the next chapter are three verses, and they're very similar. Because the end of 52 ends with the exaltation of his servant, and the end of 53 ends with the exaltation of his servant. And then you have these sets of three in the middle, 1 through 3, 4 through 6, 7 through 9, that work on the tribulation and the suffering of the Messiah in the middle. So, you know how people always tell you if you're going to give somebody bad news, make sure it's like an Oreo, okay? Good, the bad in the middle, and then end with good, okay? That's what you got. Exalted, here's the, sorry, Jesus, it's going to be really hard and people are going to hate you and kill you. Exalted, okay? You ever needed a reminder that you're going to be exalted on Judgment Day, brethren? No? Every day? Like, is this worth it? Okay, well, the Lord gave that to Jesus as well. Verse 13, Isaiah 52. Behold, my servant will prosper. He will be high and lifted up and greatly exalted. Just as many were astonished at you, my people. So his appearance was marred more than any man, and his form more than the sons of men. Thus he will sprinkle many nations. Kings will shut their mouths on account of him. For what had not been told them, they will see. And what they had not heard, they will understand. It's three verses. But man, it is packed with some cool little nuggets. Okay? So right out of the gate, we see that Jesus will be highly exalted. Verse 13. Which tells us that at some point, he was laid low. That's verse 14. The marring. The shame. Okay? And then in verse 15, we see that because of his exaltation, he is then able to perform the priestly service. You guys see that? So verse 13, he's exalted. Something that must be taken up. I mean, we say that all the time when we're trying to show water baptism, right? It's like, how did Jesus and John go down into the water? How did Philip and the eunuch go down into the water? If they went down into it, then they must have had to come up out of it, right? So if Messiah had to be exalted, then that means he was at one time, dare the scriptures say, lower than the angels? Okay, so that tells us he was exalted, but at one time he was down here. What did that look like for Jesus? Despised, forsaken, right? Beaten beyond recognition, right? But once he's exalted, he can perform his priestly duty, which is sprinkle the heavenly places. So look at verse 15. Thus he will sprinkle many nations. I think that's really cool. All right. Kings will shut their mouths on account of him. So the news will spread. And many mighty kings will pay their homage to him specifically in their silence. Okay? For what had not been told them, they will see, and what they had not heard, they will understand. Anybody want to chime in here on this one and kind of figure out what's the Lord working on here? It's Gentiles, and we see that, okay, we see the reference to the Gentiles because the many nations. He will sprinkle many nations. So now we see this is extending beyond the Jewish people. The kings, presumably of these nations, will shut their mouth in homage. Okay, he gets a moment of silence. That's kind of nice. You know, you go through all that and Jesus gets a moment of silence, you know, before the football game starts. Like, great. But what's he talking about here? The things that had not been told, they will see. And what they had not heard, they will understand. What's he specifically referring to there as it relates to the Gentiles? I would take us to Romans chapter 3. How does Romans chapter 2 end? So circumcision is not outward and not of the flesh. True circumcision is of the spirit, of the heart, done by the Spirit. Okay. So what you've just done is said, it doesn't matter if you're a Jew. Well then, why those 1,400 years under the law? Why did we do that if it was for nothing? I mean, does that theme show up in the New Testament? Absolutely. Strongly in Romans and in Galatians. Okay? So I mean, that's a reasonable question. What do you mean it doesn't matter if you're a Jew? We've been holding to this fact that we're God's people for 1,500 years, and now you're telling us it don't even matter? So now that's how chapter 3 starts. What advantage has the Jew? What is the benefit of circumcision? What is the benefit of being a Jew? His answer is it's great in every respect. Why? Because they were entrusted with the oracles of God. And Paul would later go on to explain to us that because of that, they typically fared better than the Gentiles in the realm of morality. Right? It's like, if you've got good principles, it's like, you know, a worldly family can raise their kids in the household of God under the Ten Commandments and have some pretty good principles come out of that and not even be God-fearing people, but you can live by those principles. I've had bosses tell me, I wish I could run my entire business out of the book of Proverbs. You know, I mean, you can take these principles and you can apply them and you can get the fruit of it because they are that which is good and perfect. That's the law. Okay, so what's the, okay, so the Jew, it doesn't matter if you're a Jew. And they're like, well, then what's the deal with the Jew thing? And they're like, well, it's actually great in every respect because they were given the oracles of God. They were given these very prophecies. He prepared them for 1,500 years for the Messiah. How'd it work out? Well, they stumbled and bumbled. But could you imagine if he hadn't prepared them? Do you even get 3,000 on the day of Pentecost if he hadn't prepared them? If there wasn't the oracles of God for Peter to go back to and to reason with the people? Look, Jesus fulfilled these. And then Paul goes out, and the first place he goes is into the synagogue, and he's like, reason with them from the scriptures, proving that Jesus was the Messiah from the Old Testament. That's the advantage the Jew had. Was the Gentile given the oracles of God? No. That's what he's talking about here. I guess we better make our way back. That's what he's talking about here in Isaiah 52. Okay? Jesus is going to, because of his exaltation, he will be able to offer his blood to the whole world, to the nations. He's going to get a standing ovation and a moment of silence. Kings are going to shut their mouth on account of him. Okay, they're going to pay homage to him because they understand what took place. Because they who had not been told will see. It's like all of these Greek regions that Paul went into as he traveled and brought the gospel, they weren't raised on the stories of the coming Messiah who would save his people. And they barely heard the idea of Jesus dying for their sins. I mean, that's a first for them when Paul comes through. They had not heard these things, but they got to be the benefactors of that, didn't they? Okay, so then he goes on to say, and what they had not heard, they will understand. So the Gentiles didn't have the predictive text, the stuff that we've been studying. They didn't have that. They weren't raised that way. They weren't taught this, but they still got to see it because they're participants in Jesus' resurrection if they've been immersed into his immersion. Okay, that's all I have on 13 through 15. Comments before I move on? Mike. John.
I think it's important, too, to establish, you know, God's eternal plan. He's working, you know, in these earlier years, he's starting his plan that he's got long-range goal, and that goal is to take a physical people and make them spiritual. So how do you do that? How do you communicate spiritual concepts other than through physical means? Right. And so I get that, and it's you get that through all these prophecies, is it's these start out as physical representations of spiritual realities, and that this is a great way that comes through in that we started as a physical people, the Jew, which is God's people, and he transferred that to a spiritual concept, the circumcision made without hands in Colossians 2. That's the real goal that God had in mind when he started it, but right. he had to communicate it through physical examples.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think to the earlier part of your comment too, if this is what you're trying to say, is okay. So God's got physical Israel, and he needs physical Israel so that spiritual Israel can look back and understand spiritual concepts in physical form, and then that gives us the beginning knowledge, right? So he needs physical Israel, but even when physical Israel is in its own promised land with its own priests and its own prophets, I mean, they're struggling. I mean, I told you in opening, just I mean, what a mess. Just read through 2 Kings and 1 Chronicles. It's just like...
And you think of a new Christian that's still
kind of living in a physical mindset, sure. Struggles.
Yeah. So zoom out here for a second and big picture. Like you have God who has Israel. Scripture says the law was given because of the transgression. The people were wandering like sheep so bad in their sins that he had to give them this fence, this law to keep them there. So what did he do, Mike? He said, stay away from the nations, because he's trying to preserve this remnant so he can bring about spiritual Israel. If he doesn't give them the law and tell them to shut the world out and their wives and their gods and their traditions and shut them out, he doesn't save physical Israel. But now he's got to turn around, and that's why chapters like Romans 11 show up, and they're like, what's this butting of heads with the Jews and the Gentiles? Well, the Jews were told for 1,500 years they're supposed to stay away from the nations. So what do you do if you're God working this thing from the front back, like you said, you put things like this in here so you can reason with the Jews who convert to Christianity and say, look, his goal was to always sprinkle the nations. So I mean, how he works this in, and he's able to save physical Israel but then go back and communicate to them, this was big picture meant to go out the whole time.
Yeah, it's just like it took 1,500 years for God to convince them to live this way. Now it's taken over that 2,000 years to convince some people today that this is the way it's done.
Yeah. Kate, John, you had a comment.
Well, I like how you're saying that, what you're saying, that they'll see it because they were given that and held aside to keep that. But
right.
All the world religions have a base similarity, which in my studies I found that it was the same as the Melchizedek baseline of moralities and what God had intended for Israel from the beginning, spread out through the world. They all the religions grew out of Jesus's original. And then the Israelites transgressed as long with the rest of the nations, the Gentiles transgressed. They took that pure thing that was supposed to happen and they all perverted it. And they even perverted it with the law that was given to them. But God kept that. And so when Jesus came, the reason the Gentiles were able to see was because it was in their baseline religions all along. And then with the added part of the Israelites and what they got, they were able to see that, hey, they predicted the Savior. The Savior did eventually come. This is what you've been looking for in your religions, the missing piece, but you perverted it. Here's the original that was kept by the Israelites. This is why you should follow this. And it all clicked, and they got it. And that's why a lot of Gentiles were saved.
Yeah, John, the only thing I would add on there is, you know, God's able to make his appeal to the Gentiles because he gave them a conscience just like he gave the nation of Israel. So that base of the one thing that we can all have in common is, you know, we shouldn't murder our neighbor. So, and the point you're making, maybe a lot of these things stemmed from, I'm not sure the reference to Melchizedek, but you're saying all these things stem. Well, I mean, Abraham's the father of the nation, right? So there certainly are religions today that are going to be claiming to worship the same God, and they're going to trace their religion and their ancestry back to Abraham. But there are going to be some Gentile nations that do not share that lineage or that teaching. And that's how you're going to run into like Taoism and Hinduism, because those are going to be a product of Asian Eastern nations that never plugged into Abraham, have no history with the Israelite people, and they kind of just were idol worshiping from the beginning. Yeah, if and some of those religions share that global flood view, and others don't as well, just to add on to that. So, okay, chapter 53, verse 1. Who has believed our message, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a tender shoot and like a root out of parched ground. He has no stately form or majesty that we should look upon him, nor appearance that we should be attracted to him. He was despised and forsaken of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and like one from whom men hide their face, he was despised and we did not esteem him. I do like that verse 1 starts with two interrogative sentences, two questions. So Isaiah has questions. His first question is, who has believed our message? Okay, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Now, I actually just thought of this right now, so feel free to weigh in. The hour is a plural pronoun, so who's Isaiah talking about? Whose message? Isaiah's and God's? But I also see if a prophet was indeed, take Elijah, right? Nathan, Elisha, these guys, like they were prophets of God as well. And so what I see being communicated here is Isaiah's surprised that the people don't believe. So he asked the questions. Who's believed our message? Now, I certainly believe God is included in that hour, but he's also making an appeal to the people. Man, the prophets have been telling you for a long time, and you haven't believed. Okay? He says, who's believed our message? So he lumps himself in with the rest of the prophets. Many revelations had come to pass. Why would the people consistently turn to their own plans? Okay, and again, like I think of guys like Elijah and Elisha that just time in and time out have tested false gods and found them to be idols. And God has been shown to be true in his ability to predict the famines and to sustain people through them. All the things that Elisha was able to do and helping the widow and her son and raising him and these things. And Elijah in the battle at Mount Carmel, he's like, who's believed our message? Okay, and then he goes in and he says, to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Had the people forgotten? Like, when the scripture talks about the arm of the Lord, what's it referring to? You can just shout it out. They're Jesus, yes, and? So what does the arm of the Lord do? It brings him, his power, right? So to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? It's like, well, initially, Israel, did you see any of those things? Did you forget Egypt? Hey, the prophets have been prophesying this whole time. You're not listening to our message. Have you not remembered the arm of the Lord? Now, these have spiritual connotation to them. We know ultimately how these are fulfilled. But had the people forgotten about the power of the Lord that had been extended to them over all these years? And the people would understand that in his name is salvation. And that was what Josh Gold said on Lord's Day evening that I thought was so, so well done. Salvation is in the name of the Lord. So he's got a couple of these questions. The first thing he brings up is that he would be a sprout. And this language was back in Isaiah chapter 11, right? That the Messiah would shoot forth or spring forth from the stump of Jesse. So he grew up before him like a tender shoot. So the first thing we notice is that God's watching over this thing. Messiah is going to be a tender shoot. He's going to be growing up, but it's over the careful watch of God. Okay? He will grow up before him like a tender shoot. Okay? And, you know, people, sprouts are nothing in the eyes of man. Okay? And I've told you guys before, like, I've cut down trees on my property because they're just in the way. And I've left the remnant of that stump before, and that thing, over a course of years, can start sending up new little shoots. And I don't know if that's ever going to grow back into a tree, but when I see them, I rip them off. I got rid of you, and I don't want you back. All right? So you have this idea of something starting small. I mean, the Messiah is communicated to us as a baby from Isaiah chapter 7, right? So it starts small, but it's going to be under the careful watch of God. But in the eyes of man, it's just like a tender little shoot. It's like, just snap the thing off. No big deal, all right? And he would be like a root out of parched ground. That's the picture that I think really starts to... You can see why he uses this before he goes into his appearance being the way that it is. Like a root out of parched ground. Like, I get a picture of struggling to exist. The root, it's in the ground, no water. How's the plant doing? Struggling. Struggling to exist. Maybe this will help us. Keep trees in your mind, because we're talking about stumps and shoots. What are mighty men in the Old Testament compared to? Oaks. So that's Mamre. And what else are they compared to? Your hint is Lebanon. Cedars. Important men are described like mighty oaks. Huge cedar trees. The Messiah? A little sprout. Okay. Is that who he really is? Well, of course not, but that's how the people received him. That's how the people received him. So because he was received that way, it was a struggle. I mean, was it not the last few weeks where we saw it was even predicted that not only would the Messiah suffer, but that like he would actually wonder if he's toiled in vain? Did Jesus ever have to pray to the Lord for renewing and for strength? Your will be done, not mine, Lord? Absolutely. We're at the top of the hour here, so we got to stop, but there's some verses I want to pull in just to firm up this concept here. Because I'm ending a little abruptly, I will give 30 seconds to any closing comments. Okay. All right. Appreciate your attention. Obviously, super exciting chapter. we'll transition to prayer requests and thanksgivings, and we'll spend a couple more weeks working through the rest of this.